We've got time, we've got tunes, we've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go, it's today, you know, on KSCO Radio.
Well, good morning out there. I'm Mr. Logic. I'm going to be sitting in here for the next 2 hours, so you're going to be stuck with me. So stick around and maybe we'll even have some fun. I guess it's time to quit stalling and get down to business here. Hi, I'm Mr. Logic. I don't know, maybe many of you don't know me. It's been several years since I've done a show here at KSCO, but I used to do a show called The Thinking Machine here every Sunday afternoon. And, well, I'm back again here taking Michael's place. Michael Zwirling, who's normally here, is out of town, and I guess he's somewhere out east having a good time. And so I'm stuck here doing the show, and you're stuck with me. We're going to be on from here 10 a.m. to 12 a.m., otherwise known as 0 p.m., and we're going to have a little bit different show than you're probably used to with Michael. I guess you're used to hearing a lot of political talk and things like that. Hopefully we're going to keep that to a minimum and have a little bit more interesting discussions than that. I have strict orders not to make the show too nerdy, whatever that means. So I guess I can't get too technical with any of the stuff, which kind of leaves me in a quandary. I'm not quite sure what to talk about. I have a few things, fortunately, which came up at the last minute, and maybe we'll come to those in just a little bit. First of all, I'd like to, just for those who are interested in some quasi-nerdiness, what's happening up in the sky lately. Not a whole lot. We had an interesting phenomena occur about a week ago. We had a conjunction of an alignment, actually, sort of two planets, Mars and Saturn. About a week ago, they were like less than a degree apart in the sky, which means if you were to take a small telescope, you could actually see two planets in the field of view at the same time. In fact, I did that. I actually went to the observatory up in Chico, near where I live, and they have some 12-inch telescopes up there. And I was able to actually see Saturn and its rings in the field of view in the eyepiece at the same time I was able to see the planet Mars. They were that close together in the sky. So anyway, that was about a week ago. They're moving apart now. So they're not nearly quite as close, but they're still fairly close up in the western sky after sunset. Coming up for the rest of June, tomorrow there is going to be a new moon, which means, of course, you won't be able to see the moon. And the next interesting phenomena is going to occur on July 3rd, about a week from now. Well, before I tell you about that, let me just make an observation here. We are now in summer. In fact, summer started on the 21st. That was the summer solstice. So now the days are getting longer and the temperature is getting hotter and we're heading into some summer heat in the next several months. So you might come to the conclusion now, well, now the Earth must be getting pretty close to the sun. Well, it turns out that's not the case. I mean, the Earth is actually right now moving away from the sun, not heading toward it. And on July 3rd, it's going to reach the furthest distance from the sun. And then for the next 6 months after that, the Earth will start to approach the sun. Oh, no, we're going to fall into the sun. No, we're not going to fall into the sun, but we're in an orbit, and the orbit will start to approach the sun and become closer until about January, sometime around the beginning of January. That's the time when the Earth will make its closest approach to the sun. Other than that, there's not a whole lot of interesting stuff up in the sky at the moment. So, that having been put out of the way, Let me give you some telephone numbers here if you'd like to join me on the show. Oh, by the way, you should probably also get a paper and pencil handy. Get a sheet of paper and a pencil or some writing implement. Probably, most likely, sometime during the course of the show, in fact, almost pretty soon here, I am likely to start giving some little puzzle questions or little, well, we'll see what they are. And you might want to have a pencil and paper handy to jot down some notes or whatever. In the meantime, let me give you our phone number here at KSCO. I think there's only one now, I'm told, and that's area code 831-479-1080. It's been so long, I forgot the phone number here. 479-1080. Now, if you're calling from outside the Santa Cruz area, by the way, the program is streaming live on the Internet. There may be several listeners on the Internet who are listening to the show. If you would like to call the show, you're invited to call in, too. The area code, of course, is area code 831. And if you have Skype on your computer, I'll tell you what Skype is in a minute, but if you have Skype on your computer, you'll be able to call in totally free of charge because Skype now has the facility for phoning any phone in the United States or Canada if you live in those two, either of those two countries. Skype is basically a free telephone thing that you can do with your computer. If you have Skype on your computer, you can call or talk to any other person anywhere in the world totally free of charge. If you live in the United States, as I said, you can call any telephone in the United States as well. But if you live outside the United States, you're kind of limited to only calling a person who has a computer with Skype on it. How do you get Skype on it? Very simple. Just go to Skype.com. It's a website, and you can download it free. And once you've got it free, you can talk to anybody. So, Skype users, you're invited to call into the show as well. Well, let's get started here with, let's have a couple of little warm-up quiz questions here. And once again, I have to keep these very easy. Can't make anything too complicated here. So we'll start you off with a couple of easy questions. And I may actually throw in a couple of more difficult ones later on once we get the ball rolling here. Let's see here. Here's a very easy one. Let's see how quickly you are to dial on your telephone. What uppercase letter in the English alphabet requires that the pen be lifted from the paper twice, providing no lines are retraced? What's the only uppercase English letter in the alphabet that requires you to lift the pen twice from the paper so as to avoid retracing any lines? If you want to answer the question, just give me your answer here at on the air at 479-1080, area code 831, that is. There's no prize associated with this. I don't have a pizza or anything to give away. This is just for fun, kind of a warm-up question to see if anybody's on their toes out there. 479-1080, if you can tell me what is the only uppercase letter in the English alphabet that requires the pen to be lifted from the paper twice in order to draw it, so as not to retrace any other lines already made. Well, let's see. Let's go to, we have several calls coming in right now. Let's go to Lola, I guess would be the first person. Lola, are you there?
Yes. Is it a Q?
No, it's not a Q.
Okay, thank you.
If you did a Q, you'd kind of have to come back on part of the Q and get the bottom part, wouldn't you?
That's why I thought you'd lift up the pen twice.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, then you would only have to lift it up once.
Oh, I see.
So you make the circle, you come to the Q part, and you go zip up on it. Then you pick it up once and come down and make the second half. So that would only be a one-time pickup.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
You have a good day. Welcome back.
Well, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go next to Richard. Richard, welcome to the Saturday special.
Richard.
Oh, this is that Richard. They got you listed as Richard.
00.
Yeah, 33. They should have put 33 up there, but they didn't.
I was going to say, who the hell you think you're talking to here?
I wasn't sure.
Are you ever?
I never am, actually. I mean,
that's
actually,
right.
You might be a figment of my imagination.
That's exactly right.
I've got these earphones on, and you could be a recording for all I know. You might be Memorex.
So wait a minute. We actually did eyeball each other once.
Oh, well, yeah, we've actually met on occasion, but how do I know that's you?
Only once.
Yeah, but you may not be you now.
I may not have been me then.
I'm not sure any of us are any of us, actually.
Hey, Richard. I know one thing. You're still going to believe that the Earth is round and we never went to the moon. And that gravity is pulling us down, not pushing us down.
Yeah, and I believe that light bulbs are not they're not dark suckers.
You actually got people believing it's 0-100 hours a while ago.
Well, it is.
But it was actually 0-106 minutes.
0-106 minutes. No, that won't be until midnight.
No, that's a 24-hour clock.
Well, you're talking
you were
about
using the
0 p.m.
Oh, you're using total zeros.
Well, I mean, noon will be 0 p.m., so
right.
that'll be 0 p.m.
But it was actually 06, if you want to be correct.
Not noon.
It wasn't high noon when you came on.
Well, it wasn't noon when that's right. That's why it isn't 0-0. It's 1-0.
You want the answer to your problem?
Yeah,
or
what's
not?
The answer? What's the answer we got here?
I got two, either T or G.
T or G. Well, T only requires you to lift it up once.
Oh, you want it how many times?
It has to be lifted up twice. There are a lot of them that require one lifting, but we want to find the only letter that lets you lift it up twice.
Two, and this is in printing.
In printing, right. Well, Richard, we're going to try somebody else here. Thanks for calling.
To be an X. I'll see you.
Sorry, bye-bye. Let's go to, let's see here, Larry would be next. Larry, welcome to the Saturday special.
Hi. Is it okay if I talk about an actual subject instead of your quiz?
What
are
subject?
We're just doing the quiz right now.
Well, what subject would you like to talk on?
Well, I wanted to resurrect something I used to talk to you about when you were on, did your regular show, which you scoffed at and thought was ridiculous, but I'm still convinced there's something to it because you're a guy of a man of the mind, so to speak. You're into logic, and I said I thought that the prudent, careful use of psychedelics can improve intelligence, creativity, generally make us both better people and better able to think.
Mm-hmm.
There's been since I last talked to you, there's been at least one book and several other articles pointing out the connections between computer revolution and psychedelics, and I think the sort of cultural change that happened in the 60s is the whole reason that the personal computer became desirable or even comprehensible. If I could, you know, do this little thought experiment. If you could go back in time with your iMac to 1960 and walk into the headquarters of IBM and say, everyone's going to have one of these in their house in the future, they're going to think you're crazy.
Well, of course.
They're going to say, why would anyone want their own computer?
Well, Steve Wozniak actually did something like that when he was at HP. When he proposed the Apple computer, he proposed it to his engineering department, and they told him nobody would be interested.
Absolutely. And what changed America to prepare it for personal computers was psychedelics and the cultural changes that accompanied psychedelics. People simply, our culture just simply became different. People could think of themselves as being nodes of information rather than simply passive recipients of it. They could think of themselves as being participants.
I'm not sure why psychedelics would have to play into that. I mean, I certainly didn't have anything to do with that.
The changes that happened in the 60s, it went from nothing to a computer in every house, and it was the changes that happened in the 60s and 70s that were because of that. They weren't all psychedelics. It wasn't all inspired by psychedelics, but psychedelics were a big part of it.
I would disagree and say that psychedelics had virtually nothing to do with it. I mean,
well, certainly the people in the computer industry think it did.
Well, I'm in the computer industry, and I think it didn't. So
okay,
who are you going to believe?
People in a more seminal place. You weren't there at Apple when it started.
Oh yes, I was. I got one of the first Apple computers ever made.
Okay, then you know.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I know, and I'm saying that you're wrong.
Okay. Well,
So what? So who are you going to believe? Well, anyway, it's an interesting theory. I mean, you know, I can see how you might think so.
You just didn't fully comprehend what was going on around you. I'm not saying that it was a direct connection. Hello.
Well, I mean,
I'm not saying it was a direct connection. I'm saying that it influenced how people thought. I'm not saying people came to work hallucinating and stuff. I'm saying that what they did in their off time influenced how they thought when they were at work, and they were able to think outside the box in these creative ways that they never would have without the influence of psychedelics. Many people, maybe not you, but many people in the computer industry verified that it was a huge influence.
Well, maybe for some. I mean, because the computer...
The
way the personal computer industry really started was through groups like the Stanford. They had the Homebrew Computer Club that would meet there, and they'd exchange programs and ideas for hardware. I mean, they weren't psychedelic-type guys. They were engineers. They were guys who were... They were what you would call geeks, I guess, today. I mean, they were guys who were interested in the technology. Now, maybe the general public may have come in for different reasons. That I can't say, because I don't identify with that segment. I'm more with the geeky side. But as far as the geeks are concerned, I don't think that psychedelics had a whole lot to play with it.
But many of them were what you might call psychedelic geeks.
Well, maybe some were, but then maybe...
And in fact, and when I was in high school in the 70s, it was the only people that ever talked about computers, knew what a computer was, were the people that did LSD. No one else knew what a computer was, ever heard of a computer, except in a science fiction show or something. But I mean, the computer, there was absolute correlation between the computer geeks and the people that did psychedelics.
Well, maybe your experiences are different than mine, then, is all I can say. I'm not saying you're wrong, and I'm not saying you're right. I'm just saying that...
Well, putting that aside, I mean, the whole technology part of it, I think just in general, the proper and careful use of psychedelics can improve people's minds.
I'm not sure. And there are certain drugs, of course, that can change. They're working on IQ-boosting drugs and so on. So I'm sure...
You mean like smart drugs?
Yeah, basically.
Okay, but the idea is that you don't do these things every day. You do them maybe a few times in your life, and it gives you kind of a boost. It's not like a smart drug that you would take every day. And enhances your brain chemistry or something.
Right.
This is something you maybe do, just a few times, and it just opens doors in your mind. It takes you to places that you didn't know were there. It enhances your ability to see outside of the box.
Okay, well, that may be. I mean, I don't want to think
creatively.
Yeah, I'm not trying to get into a show that suggests we all go out and take drugs so we get smarter.
No, I'm not saying that. Did you hear me say the careful and prudent use? I didn't say, hey, kid, go smoke some crack.
Yeah, I know, but the problem with this careful and prudent thing is that somebody hears it and they don't hear that part. They simply say, hey, I got an idea. We're going to go out and have some fun. So I'm just giving
it's a caveat to somebody who may be listening. It's like driving a car. If you drive a car and you're not responsible and careful, you're a danger to yourself and to everyone else.
Right.
And if you take psychedelics and you're not responsible and careful, you're going to hurt. You could hurt yourself.
Hey, Larry, we got to get moving. Got other callers here, but I appreciate your comments here, and we can talk again sometime when I'm on the air again. Thanks for calling. Nick, I guess, was next, waiting the longest. Let's see, Nick, are you there?
Yeah.
Hey, Nick.
I'm glad because I changed it twice. It's in an H.
You say it's an H. Well, that turns out that is the correct answer. I guess
you couldn't get it without backtracking it.
You said you changed it twice.
Well, I started F, but it gave F, then E would be more logical. Then I started thinking H, you have to really pick up the pen without going back.
That's right. Yeah, H, there's no way to avoid it without picking up the pen at least, you don't have to pick it up only twice. You could certainly find lots of ways to pick it up 100 times if you wanted to, but you do have to do it at least twice.
I've always wondered that you could look, that your transmitter's on an escalator, or your antenna's on an estuary or SLU or something like that?
What, I mean the KCO antenna?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, we have a lagoon back here. There's three antennas that are mounted in the lagoon itself, yeah.
I've noticed it goes up and down with the tide, but I don't see a pipe or anything that would prove that it goes into the ocean.
It does connect. I think there's a channel someplace. I remember walking around behind it and looking, and I did see a connection to the ocean, but I forget exactly what it was. It was years ago that I did it.
It's not just from the seepage.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't just seep through the ground. There actually is, as I remember, an actual channel that connects somehow.
Well, you could dig a hole near the shoreline, and it'll fill up with water.
Oh, yeah.
It's not that principle.
I don't think it's that principle, no. I mean, I didn't really make a study of it, but I mean, casual hiking around that area, I did seem to recall a channel.
Have you ever heard, looked into the distribution of oxygen and heat?
The distribution of oxygen and heat?
Yeah.
Where?
Well, on our planet, how we feel heat and how it distributes and how it relates.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously the sun provides most of the heat, and the tropical regions are going to be warmer than the polar regions. I'm not sure what you're getting at.
Well, on the moon, you'll have the sunny side will be hot very fast,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't happen like that here, or does it? They don't have oxygen there.
They don't have an atmosphere. I mean, the moon's pretty devoid. It simply gets sunlight directly from the sun. It heats up immediately. There's no clouds to get in the way. It's a different kind of a system. So it's
because I always feel better hovering. You know, a cold morning, I always feel better hovering when the sun's out, hovering over a nice little plant. And either I'm getting the evaporations. I'm also getting the oxygen directly, but I'm also might be getting water vaporizing, and that distributes heat, wouldn't that work?
Well, I mean, if you're going to go around plants, I mean, there's going to be a lot of factors that come into play. I mean, plants may be radiating some heat of their own if they stored it up. They have chemical reactions occurring, which may be exothermic, and then giving off some kind of small amount of heat. I really don't know that much about plants, so I can't say for sure.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. 479-1080 is the number here, area code 831. And if you're listening on the Internet, you're invited to call in also, area code 831-479-1080. Let's next go to Troy, I believe. Let's see. Troy, you still there?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, the guy beat me by one phone call.
Oh, the H one, huh?
Yeah, the closest. I know that because my last name starts with the letter H.
Oh, okay. So you're used to writing the letter H all the time. No fair. That'd be cheating. I'll tell you what. Since I got you on the line, I'll give you. We'll start off another quickie here, and you'll probably know the answer to this one. These are all very easy questions. So I'll give you like 5 seconds to come up with the answer, and if you can't do it, I'll have to go to the next phone call.
Sure.
Okay. Next question here for funsies. Who was the wizard of Menlo Park?
Menlo Park?
Yeah, he said, quote, genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Any ideas?
No.
Well, okay, I'll have to let you go and see if somebody else knows the answer then.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 479-1080, as I said, is our telephone number here if you want to try to answer this question. It's almost like a trivia question. You could look that up on Google to get the answer. Let's see. We have several callers who are probably still waiting for the H question. Next one is Ryan. Let's see if Ryan knows the answer. Hello, Ryan.
Hello. Yes, I thought of two letters.
For the picking up the pen twice, huh?
Yes, H. Not only H, but also I. You can't do a capital I without picking up the pen twice.
If you put those little flanges at the top and bottom, yeah, that would be true then. I guess it depends on the font you're using. Some fonts simply have an I, like for example, an Arial capital I is simply a vertical line, whereas Times New Roman has got flanges and stuff.
Yeah, true.
So, okay, that's another good suggestion, though. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one. Well, thank you for your call.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Next, we have Jim waiting. Jim, welcome to the Saturday special.
Hey, Mr. Logic.
Howdy.
It's so good to hear you again.
Well, I'm here. For better or for worse, the world is stuck with me for the next hour and a half at least.
Well, I hope we get stuck with you more often.
Well, thank you.
I unfortunately kind of lost the trail on that podcast puzzle.
Oh, the Mr. Logic's podcast riddle?
Yeah. I don't know what happened there. I went to the next step, and the link didn't go through or something or other, and I tried it several times. But
probably had the wrong answer then, because we've had several players have already made it all the way through, so the links are valid.
Oh, they are valid, and it's still up and going.
Oh, it's still up and going, yeah. We've got at least 10 players make it through. I don't more than that, actually, because I lost track after the first 10.
Oh, well, I hope that you do another one then. I'll go through and do that.
Well, actually, I have about a dozen or so puzzles I published on the Internet. Let me just take a moment here and tell you how to reach them. Anybody else who's interested in playing any of my puzzle games, just go to the Simple Codeworks website, which is www.simplecodeworks, all one word, simplecodeworks.com. And at the very bottom of that page, you'll see I don't know what you'd call them, links. Actually, they're little images, little black boxes that show seven or eight different puzzles that I've created. Mr. Logic's podcast riddle, Mr. Logic's hidden riddles, Mr. Logic's secret riddle. There's a whole bunch of riddles up there that I've made. If you click on any one of those, it'll take you to the start of those games. So anybody interested in puzzle questions, again, there's no reward for any of those games. They're just there for fun for anybody who wants to play them.
Well, I hope that you also consider doing, if not on the radio show, but a podcast version of the old Thinkers Club.
Actually, that was one of the next things I was going to talk about here right after our break. We're actually past the 10:30 mark, and so we're going to be taking a break here shortly. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about that very thing.
And you know what? I'm going to have to leave you before then, and I don't have a radio on me, so I hope that I'll be able to download that as a podcast later.
Well, I think they rebroadcast the show tonight from 10 to midnight, as I recall.
Great.
Yeah.
Wasn't Packard the Wizard of Menlo Park?
Who?
Packard?
Nope, that's not correct. Good try, though.
Bummer.
All right, thanks for calling.
All right. Good to hear you.
Bye-bye. Well, we're going to take a brief pause here for a few commercial messages, but don't go away. We still have a lot more of the Saturday special coming up, so stick around.
Tired of monkeying around with broken sprinkler heads and smelly lawn mowers? Weeds and dry patches make you scream. Growling over your decision to put a plant the size of an elephant in the space the size of an African hedgehog? Navigating your way through the maze of gardening and landscaping options and maintenance for your home or office really is enough to drive anybody wild.
Hi, I'm Randy Quilici, owner of Quilici Gardening and Landscaping. If anyone knows it's a jungle out there, it's us. We've been offering complete maintenance and landscape installation for residential and commercial properties since 1982. It's easy to let things get overgrown and out of hand and keep putting off adding that special water feature you've wanted for so long. Let us help by taming and shaping your landscape into something you'll be proud of. Call me at 425-5269 or visit us at QuiliciGardening.com.
Quilici Gardening and Landscaping, because without them, it really is a jungle out there.
I have a job to be done. It may not seem like a big job to some, but I built this business from the ground up. It's a big deal to me. That's why I went with Granite Construction for my parking lot, retaining walls, and site development. They delivered value and got the work done on time and on budget. That's covering my bottom line.
We have a job to be done. This is our home, and we wanted quality workmanship. We're talking curb appeal. It has to be beautiful. Professional and friendly expertise was what we got from Granite Construction. They've got the people and resources, and they got our job done right away.
This big project at work is important and a big reflection on me. I can't lay awake at night wondering how this job will go, so I called Granite Construction. Granite's people are backed by a culture of workmanship, safety, and quality that I just trust. And they have their own local sources for materials. Take no chances. Go with the best. That's my motto. That's project peace of mind.
Call 1-800-GRANITE. What can Granite build for you?
Big changes are coming to KSCO, ladies and gentlemen. The upcoming retirement of Phil Hendry means that weekdays from 4 to 7 p.m., our schedule will soon change. For years, we have been primarily a syndicated program radio station with some local shows. Now we plan to become a primarily local program radio station with some syndicated shows. So, starting immediately, we will be opening up our primetime schedule to more individuals and businesses who want to produce and broadcast their own talk shows on KSCO AM 1080. Our 10,000-watt blowtorch signal can be heard from north of Sacramento to south of Bakersfield in the daytime. Got something to say? A business or ministry to grow? A cause to advance? A candidate to get elected or a voter's initiative to get to pass? Become a talk show host on KSCO and make things happen. For info on rates and schedules, send an email to me, mz@ksco.com, or call my voicemail at 429-2200. That's 429-2200.
Spending time in the great outdoors doesn't have to mean roughing it, especially when you have the latest camping gear from Outdoor World. A lightweight, ultra-comfortable sleeping pad, a weather-resistant tent, or a cozy, warm sleeping bag will make spending time in the great outdoors, well, great. Outdoor World has the latest gear for camping, hunting, or fishing. Check out the new drip coffee maker from Coleman, designed to fit on camp stoves, or the cool and sturdy stainless steel Coleman ice chests. You'll also find camp cookware, cots, lanterns, and accessories. Going fishing? Check out Outdoor World's selection of fishing poles, waders, boots, and tackle boxes. And duck hunters will love Outdoor World's selection of hunting rifles, ammo, gun safes, and camo clothing. With so much gear in one place, you're bound to find what you're looking for, and maybe something a little extra, like time. Shop Outdoor World in Monterey on Fremont Street, on River Street in Santa Cruz, and on 41st Avenue in Capitola. Look for their ad in the Good Times in Monterey County Weekly. Outdoor World. We gear you for adventure.
Rocky here from Taylor Vision Satellite. If you're considering a satellite dish due to the high cost of cable and poor service and thinking of calling the 800 numbers direct, think again. Answer my phones for one day talking to people that have, and you'll understand why it's best to call Taylor Vision. I get you into the right equipment and programming the first time. With 25 years of experience, I can help. Call 476-1636 or 252-0441.
Imagine what you could do with the computer of your dreams, one made specially to take you to the edge of your talents and beyond. Since 1981, Day and Night Computer has been building custom computers for customers who have special talents and exacting standards. People like Doug Winfrey, co-host of Dead Doctors Don't Lie on KOMY.
I needed a computer in my broadcast studio that was really quiet while I was on the air. It had to be a fast and powerful computer with dual sound cards performing different tasks at the same time. Day and Night Computer understood my requirements, even improved on things I would never have thought of, and put together the best components for a great price. And wow, what a fantastic computer.
Day and Night Computer doesn't just sell a product or service. They facilitate your desired result. Call 465-7340. 465-7340. Since 1981, Day and Night Computer. Call 465-7340.
Hello, I'm Pete Middlecoff with the Santa Cruz Host Lions Club. Get in on the fun, the good, and the youth by attending the 2006 Lions Bowl this Saturday at 1 p.m. at Cabrillo College. Have fun watching the graduating seniors, all-stars from Santa Cruz County, take on the all-stars from San Mateo County and some great football. Do good because the Lions use all the proceeds from this game to help people in this community see and hear. Honor our youth by giving them a rousing send-off to their college years. Join Bill Graff and Doug Winfrey as they broadcast the game live on AM 1340 KOMY. Go for the fun, the good, and the youth. It's the 2006 Lions Bowl, Saturday 1 p.m. at Cabrillo College.
Brought to you in part by Lloyd's Tire Service. When you think quality, think Lloyd's on River Street in Santa Cruz and at the corner of Airport and Freedom in Freedom. And by Outdoor World. Before you head for the great outdoors, head for Outdoor World in Santa Cruz, Capitola, or Monterey.
As the healthcare industry has changed dramatically, people have come to the realization that they are now responsible for their own health. The complementary health movement is now a multi-billion dollar industry and is growing at a remarkable pace. This is Connie Reeder. For over 6 years, I've been a distributor for American Longevity, now Youngevity. Great new name, same great products. With Youngevity products, you can take charge of your health. By starting a Youngevity home business, you can have a fun way to get your products free or make extra money. How would you like to earn an extra $100 a month, $100 a week, or $100 a day? Just like there are no silver bullets or magic potions for your health, there are very few winning lottery tickets out there for us to win. Millions of people have realized that they can run their own business from their home, which can make life pretty meaningful. Does that sound good to you? Are you ready to become part of the complementary health movement? Join me, Connie Reeder, and the rest of the Youngevity team for one of our info nights or training meetings. For times in Santa Cruz area, call Kirk at 831-335-1108. In the Salinas Monterey area, call Connie at 831-422-3400. Bring a friend.
Well, I missed my cue there. I thought there was supposed to be a different commercial at the end there, but I guess I was wrong. Anyway, welcome back to the Saturday special. I'm Mr. Logic sitting in for the missing Michael's Whirling, who was away on vacation or something. I assume it's a vacation. I think he's having a grand old time from what I understand. And if you want to join me here, I'll be here till 0 o'clock p.m., also known as 12 a.m., also erroneously known as 12 p.m. Actually, we won't get into that right now. Here, I'll be here till noon, and the phone number here is area code 831. That's right. Forget it. Area code 831-479-1080. That's the telephone number if you want to join me here live on the air. Let's go back, first of all, and finish up. We have a couple callers who've been holding through that long series of commercials. The first one we have is, if I can find, here we go. Jack is waiting. Jack, welcome to the Saturday special.
Hi, good morning, Dr. Logic.
Good morning.
Mr. Logic. I also thought of I was for the that first question, but for the second one, I'm thinking it's probably my favorite inventor of all time, Thomas Edison.
That's correct, Thomas Edison, the Wizard of Menlo Park. I guess that's kind of a misleading question for California residents, because we have a Menlo Park here up in the northern part of the peninsula. And the first time you hear Menlo Park, the immediate connection seems to be with Stanford University, of all places, rather than the Menlo Park back east. So, so obviously Thomas Edison was not the Menlo Park wizard from here, but from back there.
That's right. And he's, like I said, one of my favorite inventors of all times. And I understand the difference between him and, let's say, like an Albert Einstein. If you were to present a problem, say a box that would have to withstand a certain amount of forces that an Einstein type would try to figure it out mathematically and figure the forces, where Thomas Edison was more pragmatic and would build a box and drop it out of a second-story window, if it broke, it wasn't strong enough.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of that old joke, you know, you're given a barometer, a student's given a barometer and has to determine the height of a building. How do you do it? Well, I mean, obviously the straightforward way is to measure the difference in air pressure, but some more creative answers are to drop the barometer off the building and see how long it takes to hit the ground and then calculate the height of the building. And the one I like the best is you find the guy who owns the building and say, hey, I'll give you this nice barometer if you tell me how tall your building is.
I like that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see, number 53 is waiting next. Number 53, welcome to, this isn't the thinking machine, but it's, it'll do for the moment. This is the Saturday special. Hey.
Hi, well, this is number 253. So, boy, and Dr. Logic, you're a sore sight for eyes.
Well, I
had the answers to those questions, but I guess I kept dialing the wrong number. I finally got shuffled around, and here we are.
Oh.
Thomas Alva Edison, what a guy.
All right. Well, let me toss another quickie out while I got you here, and you'll be the first to try this one.
Okay.
What is the only U.S. state which borders on only one other U.S. state?
Let me think now. That wouldn't be...
No, it's not Hawaii. This isn't,
no,
doesn't border.
It doesn't border any states.
Right.
I know that. Only one other state.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Let me guess, Maine?
You guessed it. Very good. It obviously had to be something sticking off someplace in a corner. Couldn't be right. And couldn't be Kansas. I mean, that wouldn't work.
Okay, I have two for you.
Here we go.
And there is a correct answer for the first one.
Okay, let's
what
try
What came first, the chicken or the egg?
Actually, I have an answer for that, but that gets into a very long diatribe.
No,
I don't
want
to get
it's
into
real simple.
This is a joke question?
No, it's a very simple question. The egg came first.
That's the traditional answer.
It's the correct answer.
No, the correct answer is they co-evolved.
No.
I mean, an egg didn't just suddenly form. It had to come from something.
Okay, let me put it to you this way. What came first, the mule or the egg?
Well, there isn't a first. The question is meaningless. That's what I'm saying.
No, it isn't. The mule came from the mule egg. There are no... Mules don't reproduce. They're a hybrid.
Well, in that case, yeah.
Okay, now chickens are hybrid too. You don't have an entire animal spontaneously evolving. It came from the egg, essentially.
And where did that egg come from?
It came from two parents who may not have been chickens, but whose progeny was a chicken, much like a horse and a donkey produce a mule. There is some point, some line that it crosses when it becomes a chicken.
So you think there was an instantaneous birth of or hatching of a chicken at some point?
I think a chicken is a hybrid. I think a chicken is a cross between two animals that were not chickens. You don't have an entire animal spontaneously mutating.
Yeah.
Look, you're lucky if you can get one cell to mutate. And that cell would be either the sperm, and let's say that it was an egg or a sperm that mutated. It still would have produced the egg.
Well, the alternative, of course, would be to have a species, maybe a lizard of some kind, which over millions of years gradually grew feathers and gradually became a chicken, but didn't happen at any point in time.
Wait, that chicken would have come from the egg.
Well,
it wasn't a lizard one day and a chicken the next.
No, that's what I'm saying. It wouldn't have. It would have gradually evolved. There wouldn't have been any point where you could point to an egg and a predecessor.
Well, yes, sir, because you are the product of the egg. You are the product of your parents' egg.
Well, okay, let's put it this way. What came first, the seed or the tree?
The seed.
Where did the seed come from?
Okay. You have plants now up in Canada that are being crossbred with pollens from... artificially genetically produced.
Yeah, but that's what man stepping in and making.
Exactly right. But what I'm saying is the resultant plants are the produce of that pollen. So the resultant plants are not either of the parents. They're a hybrid. And that's where those plants came from. The plant didn't turn into a hybrid.
No, they're not the plant itself, but I'm saying that's what evolution means. It's not that the entity itself is changing. It's that its progeny are going to be changing slightly from generation to generation.
Exactly right. And so there is a line that you cross.
Well, no, there isn't a line. That's what I'm saying. I think the thing, if it's a continuous change, from going from day to night, there isn't a line you cross where the sun suddenly becomes dark. There's a twilight zone where it gradually changes from one to the other.
No, you're wrong about that. You talk about fuzzy logic.
Yeah.
No, I think that your argument there is getting out of the fuzzy logic realm.
Well,
I think that there is, if you want to define exactly what a chicken is, and you can probably do it these days with genetic engineering, you'll find that it's the product of the parents, neither of which are chickens, that produce this thing. You can make, there's an animal in Africa called a zebu, which is the product of two dissimilar kinds of antelope. Now, they get together, and they make the zebu. But zebus don't make zebus. They came from two animals that were not zebus, and that zebu came from the egg.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that's certainly a viable possibility, but I'm saying it's not the only one.
And the second question is close enough good enough?
Is close enough good enough for what?
Well, for anything. Because if it's not good enough, it's not close enough.
I'm not sure how to respond to that.
Okay. Hey, it's sure nice to hear you again.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Good to hear you, too. Let's see here. 479-1080 is our number, area code 831. And I'm Mr. Logic, sitting in for the missing absentee Michael Zwirling, who would normally be doing the show. Tell you what, I'm gonna change the format here very quickly, so we don't get calls on the air right away. I want to talk about something here in a minute. So to keep you busy, those of you who are interested in more puzzle type questions, I know I'm not supposed to ask geeky type questions, and hopefully this one isn't too geeky. If Michael's listening, maybe he has his ears crossed or something, isn't hope he's not going to hear this question. But here's for the nerd types, I guess you might say, out there who would like to have a little more challenging puzzle than, you know, questions like what letter of the alphabet does such and such. Here's a little bit more complicated question, but not overly so. The product of three consecutive odd numbers is a six-digit number, whose leftmost digit, in other words, the most significant, leftmost digit is a 7, and the rightmost digit is also a 7. So in other words, it's a number that begins with a 7 and ends with a 7. And it's the product of three consecutive odd numbers. What is this six-digit number that I'm referring to? If you figure out the answer to that, don't give it on the air. Give it to my call screener. And he will write it down. And perhaps maybe after we come back from the news break at the top of the hour, I'll collect the answers and see if anybody's got it right. The phone number to give your answer to our call screener, area code 831-479-1080. Once again, the question, the product of three consecutive odd numbers is a six-digit number whose leftmost digit is a 7 and whose rightmost digit is also a 7. What is the entire six-digit number? Okay, we'll put that aside for the time being. Before we took our commercial break, I promised I was going to talk a little bit about perhaps podcasting and things like that. Well, let me first of all start off by giving you a little bit of my background here for the past couple of years while I've been away from KSCO. I moved to Paradise, California, up near Chico a couple of years ago. Since I've been up there, I've been doing a number of computer games and puzzle questions and stuff like that, which I put on the Internet. And as of late, one of those games, by the way, as we were talking about before the commercial break, is a game called Mr. Logic's Podcast Riddle. And it's actually a series of podcast segments where you have to answer a puzzle question to get to the next segment. And I'll warn you in advance, it's a non-trivial game. So if you're looking for a challenging game, that one might be what you're looking for. Anyway, getting back to podcasting, one of the things Michael and I have talked about some of this stuff. Some of the stuff we haven't talked about yet. I'm just going to present it now for the first time. Michael would like me to come back and do a podcast series of, I don't know what you'd call them, series of shows, podcasts that would be available on the Internet. And we've also talked about perhaps doing live shows such as I'm doing now. But instead of having me drive all the way down from the Chico area down to Santa Cruz, which is a couple hundred miles, I would like to be able to do that kind of a show from my home. So I can, obviously with the price of gas the way it is, any kind of savings like that would be certainly a good thing for me. So we've experimented a couple of times now using Skype, which I talked about at the beginning of the show. By using Skype from my home, I can actually call in to the KSCO transmitter here, and in principle, I can actually do a show from up there. Now, the problem is Skype is not, unfortunately not a very reliable medium for transmission of voice information. It works reasonably well. I have no objections to it. But unfortunately, as far as the perfectionists are concerned, it does have occasional dropouts and things like that, little glitches that happen. So they don't want to use it for professional broadcasting. So what I'd like to do, if it were up to me, if I were the owner of this station, here's what I would do for my particular case. I would start doing broadcasts over the Internet, which would be also possibly made into podcasts. That's just a matter of recording the same information and making it available as an MP3 file, for example. But the podcast itself, the webcast itself would be a real-time thing where anybody in the world could tune in and hear it. Also, by using Skype, since Skype is readily available now free of charge, anybody listening to the show would be able to call in on Skype from anywhere in the world, and we'd have a real-time conversation, much like we're doing here now at KSCO. At KSCO, the problem is that most of the listenership is in the immediate area. We're covering maybe a few thousand square miles of territory. With the Internet, we'd be covering millions of square miles of territory, and the listening audience would be quite large. So I'd much rather approach it from that point of view. And so, as I said, my plans, which I'm going to probably talk to Michael about when he gets back, is to try to pursue that idea, maybe using the internet streaming facilities that KSCO has to do a real-time show from my home up in Paradise and be able to essentially do what I'm doing now, only not having to come to the station. So those are my kind of ideas for right now. Let's see, we're coming up, we got about 5 minutes, we're going to have to break for news. In the meantime, let me repeat this question, which I put out here before I talked about what I just talked about. The product of three consecutive odd numbers is a six-digit number. The leftmost digit of that number is a seven. The rightmost digit is also a seven. What is the entire number that I'm thinking of? If you know the answer, call it in, give it to our call screener, and I will collect those answers here at the top of the hour. And when we come back from the news break, I'll see if anybody got the right answer. Let's see here. We got a couple minutes to kill. Here are, in the process of looking for some trivia questions, I came across some trivia which I'm not quite sure how to put them into the form of a question, but they're kind of interesting. And so I thought I'd simply bring a couple of those up. One of them has to do with the idea of when you toast somebody, you take a glass of wine, you clink the glasses together and you say cheers or skål or whatever. Why do you do that? What is the purpose of clinking glasses together when you make a toast with somebody? Well, it turns out, according to the source that I found here, in ancient Greece, a common method of dealing with one's enemies was to poison them. So as a precautionary measure, which was developed for both the guest and the host, they would pour a little of each other's wine into each other's glasses. As that would be a kind of a sign of trust that they were not trying to poison each other. And today that has come down to simply clinking the glasses together rather than actually pouring the wine from one glass to the other. So next time you give a toast to somebody, you're actually saying, here, I trust that you're not trying to poison me. An interesting little piece of tidbit. Also, another one which I found, you may have noticed that on a woman's shirt or a man's shirt, the buttons are in opposite directions. On a man's shirt, the buttons are on the right, and on a woman's shirt, they're on the left. You know why that is? Well, according to the source I have, a long time ago, women generally had another woman help them get their clothes on. And so the buttons were placed on the other side backwards from the from a person doing it to themselves to make it more convenient for their maid or whoever it was that would be helping them become adorned. So that's why buttons are faced in opposite directions on a man's shirt versus a woman's shirt. Let's see, we've probably got time for another one here. You've heard probably by now words like orange, rhymes with orange. There are no words that rhyme with orange, you say. It turns out there are words that rhyme with orange, but there are a couple of other words, pint, skeleton, limited, and restaurant, for example, which apparently have no words that exactly rhyme with them. The words like orange, silver, and purple, and so on, which are commonly quoted, are words that have no rhyming alternatives in common usage. However, there are some words that do rhyme with orange, one of which is not very common, is called sporange, S-P-O-R-A-N-G-E, which is a receptacle for spores used in biology. Chilver, C-H-I-L-V-E-R, is a type of lamp or a sheep, goatskin type of... It's kind of an animal, depending on which source you're talking about. And purple rhymes with chirple, curple, C-U-R-P-L-E, which is a rump or a person's backside. So there are words that do rhyme with orange, silver, and purple, even though the popular opinion seems to be that there aren't any such words. Let's see, we're coming up on the top of the hour here pretty quickly. Let me just remind you, you're listening to the Saturday Special. I'm Mr. Logic, sitting in for Michael, who would normally be here. And one last time here, I'm going to give you our little background quiz. The product of three consecutive odd numbers is a six-digit number whose leftmost digit is a seven and whose rightmost digit is also a seven. What is that entire six-digit number? If you know the answer, give it to our call screener here at area code 831-479-1110. 1080, and I'll be collecting those answers shortly to see if anybody got the correct answer to that one. In the meantime, now, we're just about ready for the start of Fox News. We're going to be going to Fox News here in just a few seconds. So, once again, don't go away, because we've got another hour. We're going to be going till 0 o'clock p.m., and I'm Mr. Logic. Hang around, and I'll see you then.
Up-to-the-minute news and the best in talk, AM 1080, KSCO Santa Cruz, and AM 1340, KOMY Watsonville.
www.kseo.com.
The following is a KSCO commentary. Here is Kay Zwirling.
How long have you known about H.R. 219, the Social Security Preservation Act of 1999, which was meant to ensure the integrity of the Social Security trust funds? It has yet to be voted upon 7 years later. While for many years we've been told by our congressional leaders that the Social Security system was in trouble for lack of funds, what they neglected to tell us that the reason the funds were evaporating was because they, our loyal representatives, whom we trust to do the right things for us, have instead been raiding the Social Security savings trusts for their own projects, for their own districts, often unnecessary, frivolous projects like bridges that don't go anywhere, just so that they can remain in office. This smells bad. I learned about this law, H.R. 219, recently by chance, when a group of private citizens were soliciting for funds from the public to force our Congress to bring H.R. 219 to a vote. Evidently, politicians were helping themselves to millions and millions of dollars and leaving IOUs in place, which will never be paid back. That's why the Social Security funds have been diminishing. Naturally, this shameful information has not been publicized by our leaders until some members of Congress with integrity created H.R. 219 to stop this dishonest practice so Social Security funds will no longer be used for private projects. Each one of us must demand that our representatives come clean and vote for H.R. 219 now at once and stop this financial hemorrhaging. Literally, it's stealing from the public. When H.R. 219 is law, there will be plenty of funds in the Social Security system for the worried baby boomers and for many other generations to come. Had our politicians been on Social Security like the rest of us, this robbery would never have happened, which opens up another Pandora's box. I believe that the Congress's own retirement fund is totally illegal and should be challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that our elected leaders can make arbitrary laws for their own personal benefit. We elected them to make laws for all of us, but they're getting away with this seizure of the public's money. The irony. Our elected leaders have dragged their feet on this problem for 7 years, continuing to do what they knew was wrong, and now must make a law to make themselves honest. Again, the Congress should be forced to give up their own retirement fund and be part of the Social Security system like the rest of us Americans. For KSCO and KOMY, this is Kay Zwirling.
We now rejoin Fox News already in progress.
Hank Weinblum, Fox News Radio.
Tennis great Andre Agassi is retiring. The 36-year-old has been hampered by back trouble. He's played only 8 matches this year. He announced today at Wimbledon that his last match will be the U.S. Open. Agassi played over 2 decades, collecting a career Grand Slam. TV's prolific producer has died.
And now they work for me. My name is Charlie.
Charlie's Angels, just one of producer Aaron Spelling's many blockbuster successes. Spelling suffered a stroke on June 18th. He died at his super mansion in Los Angeles. He was 83. I'm Lisa Carton, Fox News Radio.
www.kseo.com.
And you're listening to KSCO AM 1080. It's 5 minutes past 11 o'clock. I'm Jay Cruz with a look at your Central Coast weather forecast for today. Calls for mostly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning with southwest wind at 5 miles per hour with highs around 67. Tonight, mostly cloudy with fog, northwest wind around 3 miles per hour with lows around 53. Sunday, mostly cloudy with patches of fog in the morning and southwest wind at 7 miles per hour with highs around 66. Sunday night, mostly cloudy, fog with south wind around 5 miles per hour with lows around 54. Monday, partly cloudy with patches of fog in the morning, highs around 65. Monday night, partly cloudy with fog, lows around 53. Tuesday, partly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning and highs around 65. Your Monterey Bay Borders forecast for today calls for light winds becoming southwest 5 to 10 knots in the afternoon with wind waves at 1 foot and northwest swell 2 to 5 feet every 9 seconds with areas of dense fog in the morning and then patchy fog in the afternoon. Stay tuned to KSCO AM 1080 for hour number 2 of the Saturday special with special guest host, Mr. Logic. Stick around.
www.kseo.com.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back.
Welcome back, everybody, to hour number 2 of the Saturday special. I'm your host, Mr. Logic, sitting in for the vacationing Michael, who is back. I think he's back in Tennessee at the Grand Ole Opry, from what I understand. Let's see here. Well, we got a couple of old businesses to take care of before we get into some new stuff. In the first half of the show, I gave a little quickie puzzle question. The product of 3 consecutive odd numbers is a 6-digit number, whose leftmost digit is a 7, and whose rightmost digit is also a 7. What is that entire 6-digit number? Well, we got responses, correct responses, by the way. Nobody got the wrong answer. I guess it's kind of hard to get a wrong answer on that one. First correct answer came in from Thinkers Club member number 14. Next came Margaret. The third one came in from Thinkers Club member 253, followed by Eddie, followed by number 611, also known as Leslie, and Jack also had the correct answer. And what was that correct answer? 753207. That's the product of 89 times 91 times 93. Well, anyway, I guess we do have some thinking types out there, some nerdy types, perhaps. Not everybody, I guess, is quite as down on thinking as Michael would seem to think they were. Before we get into any new topics here, we still have a caller on hold. We have Dave who wants to talk about the Twin Towers. Let's bring Dave up. Hello, Dave. Welcome to the Saturday special.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on, Mr. Logic. I always appreciate it when you're on. I usually turn in when I can.
Oh, well, thank you.
Hey, this Twin Tower thing has kind of got me perplexed in the notion that looking at it from the perspective of gravitational velocity, Now, as we know, you know, the 32 foot per second, you know, it doubles in 2 seconds, and then add another, I forget the term what you call that, but another 32.
Well, it's an acceleration, 32.
Exactly. Okay, well, at that rate, we have an object that could fall to 1,350 foot at near sea level conditions in approximately 9.2 seconds. Okay, now then, on page 305 of the official terrorist report, the government claims that the South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds, 8-tenths of a second slower than if it would have been dropped in a vacuum, with a total disregard of all the air, steel, glass, and every other thing that created resistance slowing that collapse. What is your opinion? This theory of theirs seems faulty to me. I don't see how it could possibly be true, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on it.
Well, I hadn't really thought about it. I haven't seen any report like that, but assuming your data is correct.
Well, it's in the official report on page 305. The government claims the South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds.
Now, I guess we need to, first of all, define how they defined collapse. I mean,
I believe the first initial movement of the building collapsing. From that time until the hit the bottom. It obviously isn't the half an hour that from the attack to when the building started to crumble and fall. Like I say, on page 305 of the report, the government purports that it happened in 10 seconds. It's right there in black and white.
Well, I remember watching it happen live when it occurred, but
right.
I didn't time it.
Well, what do you think? If the government's report is right, and I've looked at the video and I've timed it with just a hand watch, and it is about 10 seconds, and it just seems to me that is just a ridiculously low number. How on earth could all that stuff get out of the way to have that thing collapse at near gravitational velocity? It just seems ridiculous to me.
It does sound a little strange, yeah, but if it did happen, then I guess you can't argue with the facts that you said you timed it yourself, right?
Well, it's not arguing with the facts. The entire question would rely on the structural integrity at lower levels being compromised by the use of high explosives or some kind of a new unknown technology that we don't know of. That the government has, or whoever has, that could actually compromise the integrity of the structure.
Are you saying they actually intentionally brought it down then, with the government's knowledge, and that they actually?
Well, I don't see how else it could happen. How could the building fall so quickly? It just seems ridiculous to me.
Well, as I remember seeing a collapse, it didn't just all collapse suddenly. I mean, the top story started collapsing on top of the ones underneath and then
right.
So on down.
Well,
and
the government still has this number of 10 seconds, which is 8-tenths of a second slower than the formula that it provides the 9.2 seconds for the 1,350 foot.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. You would think that as each successive level hit the one below, it would be stopped temporarily and starting over.
Well, absolutely. I think if they came up with a number like 25 or 30 seconds, it could be almost half believable. But to say it happened in 10, once again, page 305 for all those people out there. You can just go to any search engine and just type in official 911 report, and there it is. And it's page 305, plain as day, 10 seconds.
Hmm.
Anyways.
Well, thanks for the information. Interesting point.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for calling. 479-1080 is the number if you want to get on the air, area code 831. But if you want to call, hold off for just a bit here because I want to talk about something here, which I figure after all, I spent some time trying to get ready for the show in case nobody called in. And so I put together some material here, which I, in thinking about, I think is kind of fun to talk about. And so I want to spend a few minutes at least talking about something that was in the news yesterday. This is dated June 23rd from CNN. In an effort to try to keep this show from getting too nerdy and too technical, I wasn't quite sure what to talk about because, I mean, if you talk about science, you're right away getting somewhat nerdy just by definition. And I figured probably a good way to be a compromise on that idea of not getting too technical and still having something at least pseudoscientific, UFOs turn out to be an interesting thing to talk about, and they were in the news as of yesterday on CNN. Here's a report that I got off the internet. It says UFOs and alien visitors are part of our culture. a far-out phenomenon when judged against those low-life wonders, Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. After all those years, as the saying goes, UFOs remain a riddle inside a mystery wrapped in an enigma. Why is that so? Well, for one, the field is full of hucksterism, and it's got blurry photographs and awful videotapes and all that kind of stuff. But then there's also the well-intentioned and puzzled witnesses that actually saw something. Scientifically speaking, are UFOs worth keeping an eye on? Well, there have been advances in the field of UFO research, according to Ted Rowe, who's the executive director of the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, also known as NARCAP, N-A-R-C-A-P. And NARCAP was established about 6 years ago and is dedicated to the advancement of aviation safety issues as they apply to what they term Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, or UAP. So I guess they're changing the abbreviations now to make them a little more respectable. UFO seems to have gotten kind of a smudge on its face, and so now they're going to call them UAPs, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. NARCAP has made the case, and this is what I find kind of interesting. NARCAP has made the case that some of these phenomena have unusual electromagnetic properties. You may remember hearing, you know, somebody says, well, the lights in their car fluctuated or, you know, whatever, when the flying saucer came by. Continuing, he says, therefore, they could disrupt microprocessors and adversely affect avionic systems. And for those reasons and others, UAP should be considered a hazard to safe aviation. Now, there's a little bit different tactic than anybody's tried before. I mean, everybody talks about seeing UFOs and blah, blah, blah. But if they really do exist and if they really do give electromagnetic hazards, then that is something that really needs to be considered. He says, it is likely that that these conclusions will fly in the face of the general assertion that UAPs are not real and that there are no undocumented phenomena in our atmosphere. This should open the door, he says, to the realization that there is no good reason to discard the outright possibility that extraterrestrial visitations have or may be occurring. A little bit different point of view. I mean, if what he's saying, if you think about that, you're not allowed to take computers and calculators on a plane when it's taking off because supposedly it's going to possibly cause electromagnetic interference when they need to be in communication. If that's really true and the airlines do have to have clear airwaves, so to speak, with no electromagnetic waves getting in the way, then UFOs do need to be investigated. You can't just sweep them under the carpet anymore and say, well, they don't really exist. UFO debunker Robert Schaffers on his website says that he's skeptical to the max. He's a fellow of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal and a well-known writer on the UFO scene. Being, as he calls, an equal opportunity debunker, Schaefer notes that he refutes whatever nonsense in his judgment, quote, stands in the greatest need of refuting, no matter where it comes from. After all, he says, sacred cows make the best hamburger. In regards to the this cottage industry of UFO promoters, there's still so many snake oil sellers around is because of the fact everybody's so gullible. It's because nobody anywhere has any actual facts concerning alleged UFOs, merely claims, and that's what allows these con men to thrive thrive on peddling their yarns. UFO believers are convinced that the existence of UFOs will be revealed any day now. But it's like Charlie Brown and the football. No matter how many times Lucy pulls the football away, these promised disclosures fail to happen. However, the believers are dead certain that next time will be their moment of glory. I would have to say that we're stuck in neutral, says Kevin Randall, a leading expert on UFOs. Randall points to several stories from the past, one going back to 1897 to an airship crash in Aurora, Texas, which had long been proven to be a hoax by two con men. Yet that story still continues to surface in UFO circles. Then, of course, there's the celebrated Mantell event, a pilot who lost his life chasing a UFO back in 1948. There are those who contend that he was killed by a blue beam from a UFO, even though we've known for years that the UFO was a balloon, and he violated regulations by flying above 14,000 feet without oxygen equipment. He says, I mean, we know this, and yet there are those who believe that Mantell was killed by aliens. I've no doubt that UFOs are here to stay, said Seth Shostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, who, by the way, I interviewed on the Thinking Machine here a few years ago. Continuing, he says, I'm just not convinced that alien craft are here to stay, or for that matter, even here for brief visits. First, despite a torrent of sightings for more than half a century, I can't think of a single major science museum that has alien artifacts on display, Shostak said. Contrast this paucity of physical evidence with what the American Indians could have shown you 50 years after Christopher Columbus violated their sea space. They could have shown you all kinds of stuff, including lots of smallpox-infested brethren as proof that they were being visited. Calling it an argument from ignorance, Shostak pointed to the claim that aliens must have careened out of control above New Mexico desert simply because some classified government document sports a bunch of blacked-out text. How does the latter prove the former, he says. Sure, the missing verbiage is consistent with a government cover-up, but it's also consistent with an infinitude of other scenarios, not all of them involving sloppy alien pilots. Shostak said it is not impossible that we could be visited. It doesn't violate physics to travel between the stars, although that's not easy to do. But really, if you're going to claim, or for that matter, believe, that extraterrestrials are strafing the cities and occasionally assaulting the neighbors with an aggression inappropriate on a first date, then I urge you to find evidence that leaves little doubt among the professionally skeptical community known as the world of science. So that was a report that just came out yesterday on CNN, and I'm not quite sure where I stand on this UFO thing. I've always been interested in UFOs ever since I was a kid, and I remember reading about the Mantell incident and all that kind of stuff. And the problem is, though, is that I'm also an amateur astronomer and actually somewhat a professional astronomer as well. And in all my years of looking at things in the sky, there has never, with one exception, which I'll mention in a minute, and even that isn't an exception, I have never seen anything I couldn't ultimately identify. I mean, I've seen weather balloons, I've seen meteors, I've seen planets, airplanes, satellites. I've seen all kinds of things in the sky, but I was always able to identify them. Now, maybe it was an airplane. I couldn't tell you if it was a DC-7 or what model number, but I could at least identify it to the extent that it was a generic airplane of some kind and not a UFO. There was one exception, which actually isn't an exception now that I listen to myself talking. A number of years ago, I was in Las Vegas. And I was walking on the main strip where all the lights are and everything. And for some reason, I decided to take a hike off of the main course where everybody's hanging around. And I walked down one of the side streets where there was hardly anybody. In fact, it was dark because that particular street had some construction work going on. There was a big empty lot where they were beginning to build something, but it was all dark, no lights at all. And as I walked, I kind of looked up in the sky, and suddenly I saw something. It was a bluish light flying from, I believe, the southeast to the northwest. And it was passing almost directly overhead, and it wasn't a point. I mean, it wasn't like an airplane flying up in the sky where you see a little dot. This actually had a physical dimension to it. It was probably about the size of a full moon in terms of the amount of space it took up, angular size. And it was perfectly silent, made no sound at all. It was a faint bluish light glowing in the sky as it was flying in a straight line at constant speed. I looked at it, and at first I didn't know what it was. I was wondering, well, hey, maybe this is Area 52 here and not too far away. Maybe this is some kind of strange visitation. Who knows what? And I watched it for a few minutes. And then it suddenly dawned on me what I was looking at. It turned out it was a bird flying reflecting on its underside belly, the light feathers reflecting the lights of Las Vegas from all around me. And up in the sky, it looked like this phantom blue glowing object flying across the sky. Now, I can imagine if somebody else who was not as skeptical as I would be might look at this thing and run back to the strip saying, "Hey, everybody, I saw a UFO. Look, look, look up there. Oh, it's gone now. But I saw it, and it had flashing lights, and it had a little green man." I mean, these things can kind of get blown out of proportion very easily. But on the other hand, it's possible that there may be extraterrestrial intelligence someplace. Obviously, SETI is looking for it. And don't know. Anyway, I'll come back and talk a little bit more about this in just a moment. Let me go back to the phones right here. We have Liberty, who's been waiting for a while. Let's bring Liberty up. Liberty, welcome to the Saturday special.
Hello, Mr. Logic.
Howdy.
It's good to hear you back.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Oh, good. Of course, we refer to this area around here as paradise. It's interesting we had to move away to paradise. But...
Well, the paradise I come from isn't as hellishly expensive.
So it's a little closer to paradise.
More of a true paradise, yeah.
Yeah. Well, UFOs are an interesting subject, but I'm going to stick with what I wanted to ask you when I heard you were going to be on the radio this weekend. Sort of a tangential issue to global warming is I'm interested in your take on the claim that there is unanimity among scientists and especially climatologists that there absolutely is global warming and that human activity is absolutely contributing in a significant manner.
Well, it's funny you should ask that. One of the topics I have in front of me here was something I was going to maybe talk on briefly. This was also from CNN, and this was dated 2 days ago, June 22nd. The headline says, "Earth is likely the hottest it's ever been in 2,000 years."
Yeah.
And this apparently is from the National Academy of Sciences, who's reached this conclusion. I'm not going to read the whole story. Anybody interested can find it at CNN.com. In fact, it's probably one of the headline stories up there right now. But basically, it talks about the idea that the Earth apparently is, you know, becoming more of a consensus that there may be some truth to the idea that man is helping change the environment of the planet in terms of the global warming effect. But now let me preface this with just a minute. Mm-hmm. The headlines tend to be a little sensationalistic, as they tend to be, of course. And that the way they word this, let me read this, says, I'll read it literally, study, colon, Earth likely hottest in 2,000 years. Well, that sounds rather sensational, hottest, like we're going to burn up.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say that the Earth is warmest in 2,000 years, it's hottest in 2,000 years. Well, you know how much hotter it is?
Oh, by a couple of degrees, maybe?
1 degree.
1 degree, okay.
It says here, in their 155-page report, the average global surface temperature in the northern hemisphere rose about 1 degree during the 20th century.
Mm.
Now, that's hottest that it's ever been.
Yeah.
See, that's why when you look at these headlines, you got to watch out that you're not being huckstered here by the press who may or may not know what they're talking about.
Right. Well, the particular aspect of this that I wanted to focus on was this idea. Now, you mentioned that there is approaching consensus, and all the mainstream media and Al Gore. I went to see An Inconvenient Truth last week. He's claiming that, or it is claimed by more than him, that the only skeptics are employees of oil companies and energy companies, that there aren't any independent or scholarly climatologists that do not agree that we are contributing to global warming. I'm just wondering if that's the case.
Well, I'm not an expert on global warming, but I mean, my own personal opinion is that I would tend to agree that obviously, you know, man has influenced the environment quite a bit, not only just in terms of global warming, but in terms of species that have died off that wouldn't have otherwise, and so on.
Right.
We're certainly making an impact on our environment, so it isn't out of the question to presuppose that global warming could definitely be attributed to something we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I'm just, you know, one other thing that puzzles me is it was reported, and it didn't get a lot of press, that the polar ice caps of Mars are melting.
Well, they do. I mean, they tend to recede, and I mean they're also doing, you know, every 2 years. I mean, Mars goes around the sun, and it's going to have seasons just like on the Earth.
Uh-huh.
Because it has a tilt in its axis, and it's an elliptical orbit, and all the rest of the stuff.
Right, but this sort of implied, this article, that it was more than just seasonal. That, and I'd also heard that there is other evidence of a solar system-wide influence of warming on Mars, more than just Earth and Mars, and that it could be linked to the sun, the solar cycle, where the sun is actually heating up more than it has been in years.
Yeah, the solar constant isn't really a constant. I mean, that's been known now for a while, too. There's a number of factors that can contribute to those kinds of things. But that doesn't say that humans aren't also contributing.
Right. But then there's this thing called the butterfly effect, which purports that a butterfly flapping its wings
and
the Himalayas will contribute to, the changing weather pattern to some extent.
That's only true. That's only true if you have like a singular point in the equations involved. And in the case of a butterfly, that's kind of fallacious because the flapping. It's like the argument: if you stepped on a butterfly and you went back in time, that could alter the course of history. Mm. Well, in reality, it probably wouldn't. I mean, it could, but I mean, you talk about what could versus what's likely. You're talking two different scenarios now.
Right. And then you hear statistics like there were more pollutants pumped into the air by the eruption of Mount Pinatubo than all of human activity since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So just makes me wonder to what degree, and if we were to stop all human activity tomorrow, would it reverse the warming of the climate?
Well,
or is this something that's inevitable?
I don't think that stopping tomorrow would have that quick an effect. I mean, some of these things have long-term buildup type things associated with them. You have to affect the ozone layer, and that has to affect other things, and climates have to change. I mean, it's not something where if you just threw a switch, it would instantaneously change anything.
Right. And then it was also in an inconvenient truth, and I've heard this elsewhere, that a period of rapid warming, climate change toward the warmer, may actually precipitate another ice age because of changing the flow of the Gulf Stream along the Northern Europe and the British Isles.
Yeah, it kind of points out the frailty of our species and our planet. When you can start talking about a 1 or 2 degree temperature change having such catastrophic effects, it makes it almost, because I used to wonder, you know, how could dinosaurs become extinct because a big meteor crashed into the Earth? I mean, that sounded kind of implausible to me. But when you think about that, I mean, if you have a collision with an asteroid into the Earth and it put up a dust cloud, well, heck, if only 1 degree changes is causing us to worry about things here, imagine what a disaster that would be to have an asteroid crash into the Earth, and it's become suddenly quite plausible that the dinosaurs were killed that way.
Right. Yeah. Well, anyway, it's great having you back, and I'll get back to work and listen to you on the radio.
Oh, thanks for calling, Liberty.
Okay, you bet.
Bye-bye. See, we're coming up on our break time here. I'll tell you what, we'll take one more call here. We have Rory wants to talk about global warming. I don't want to spend the rest of the time talking about global warming, but we'll take at least one more call on the subject here. Rory, welcome to the Saturday special.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Logic. The reason I'm talking about brought this for continuing with the subject is just that the economic impact it'll have on us, if those that are believers in global warming have their way, it'll be staggering. Most people don't understand what's at stake. Anyway, the question for you
question for you quickly. Where are you calling from?
Watsonville.
Oh, so you're in Watson. Okay.
Yeah. The question I have for you is, what is the predominant greenhouse gas in the atmosphere? Do you know?
Is this a trick question?
No.
It's
straightforward.
I would assume it. I mean, traditionally, I was told it was carbon dioxide. Am I wrong?
It's actually water vapor.
Water vapor. Okay. Well,
the quick and dirty test for this is, in the middle of winter, what's colder, a clear night or a cloudy night?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's been well known that, you know, radiation into space is what causes.
Yeah. So there's the, and I don't know what the ratio is, but there's an infinitesimal difference between CO2 and water vapor in the atmosphere. So this whole thing's a hoax. And not only that, when they come up with these lies, like the warmest or the hottest it's been in 2,000 years, they conveniently overlook the medieval climate optimum around 1,000, 1,100. They don't talk about the Little Ice Age.
They actually do talk about that.
Well, yeah, but did they tell you that you're still, we're still warming out of the Little Ice Age?
Let me see here, Bubba.
That's a fact. Between... It was 4 degrees warmer in the medieval climate optimum than it is now. And the Romans farmed grapes in southern England. Okay, so these guys are, if they look up, if people do an adequate search, there are two sides of the story, and these journalists are liars, or the editors are liars. They're not doing their job, which is to bring you both sides of the story and let you make up your mind.
Well, let me just quote from the article that I was referring to here, the last couple of paragraphs. It says, overall, the panel agreed that the warming in the last few decades of the 20th century was unprecedented over the last 1,000 years, though relatively warm conditions persisted around the year 1000, followed by a little ice age from about 1500 to 1850.
Okay. So they said it's unprecedented, but they don't tell you that the medieval climate optimum was 4 degrees warmer than we are now.
No.
That's been published, and people can go read it. Talk to a Dr. Sally Bolanius and others. There's plenty of Dr. Singer. There's hundreds of scientists that say global warming is a fabrication, or we don't have enough information to draw these kind of conclusions. That's why the Kyoto Protocol wasn't signed by the U.S. Senate or ratified by the U.S. Senate, because there's not enough information. And these chicken littles are running around. You ought to know this. You're Mr. Logic. You got to be careful about what you believe and understand based on evidence.
Well, of course.
And you got all these people running around saying, we're overheating. You know, and then they forget that water vapor is greenhouse gas. They don't want to talk about that. So it frosts me, no pun intended. And I'm glad you bring it up. And I would say you ought to look into it. You're an intelligent guy. Look into it. Do some research. Find out the truth, and then let's talk about it next time.
Okay, I'll do the best I can.
Thanks, Mr. Logic.
Thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Well, let's see here. We're past our halfway point of the second half of the show, so we're going to take a brief pause here for a few commercial messages. And when we come back, I want to continue talking about this idea of UFOs, but from a completely different point of view than what you're probably thinking I'm going to talk about. Stay tuned.
www.kseo.com KOMY AM 1340 KSCO AM 1080
Up to the minute news and the best in talk. AM 1080, KSCO Santa Cruz, and AM 1340, KOMY Watsonville.
In the great outdoors doesn't have to mean roughing it, especially when you have the latest camping gear from Outdoor World. A lightweight, ultra-comfortable sleeping pad, a weather-resistant tent, or a cozy, warm sleeping bag will make spending time in the great outdoors, well, great. Outdoor World has the latest gear for camping, hunting, or fishing. Check out the new drip coffee maker from Coleman, designed to fit on camp stoves, or the cool and sturdy stainless steel Coleman ice chests. You'll also find camp cookware, cots, lanterns, and accessories. Going fishing? Check out Outdoor World's selection of fishing poles, waders, boots, and tackle boxes. And duck hunters will love Outdoor World's selection of hunting rifles, ammo, gun safes, and camo clothing. With so much gear in one place, you're bound to find what you're looking for, and maybe something a little extra, like time. Shop Outdoor World in Monterey on Fremont Street, on River Street in Santa Cruz, and on 41st Avenue in Capitola. Look for their ad in the Good Times in Monterey County Weekly. Outdoor World. We gear you for adventure.
It takes a lot of energy to sell your home, a lot of energy to spare.
Hello, I'm Heidi Theodore with Sherman and Boone Real Estate, and I do have energy to spare. Listen.
Hi, fellow KSEO listeners. This is Mark Fogel. Last year, when I wanted to sell my house, I watched a six-month contract with one agent expire and a three-month contract with another agent expire, and still I had no sale, and I didn't know what my next move should be. Then, I heard Heidi Theodore's amazing ad on KSEO, and I figured, how could I not call her? After all, she had the energy to sell my home, and sell it she did, even before we did the improvements that she has suggested. So if you're thinking about selling your home, I highly suggest you call Heidi Theodore. She is a ball of positive energy. She'll get the job done, and you will enjoy meeting her, I promise.
When it's time to sell your home, list with someone with energy to spare. That's me, Heidi Theodore, at 831-818-1256. That's 818-1256. Or HeidiTheodore.com. Oh, by the way, there's only one Heidi Theodore, and that's me.
J.C. Heating and Air Conditioning was started in 1975 by John and Carol Hadley. I'm Chris, and when you call J.C. Heating, I'm the guy who's going to come over to your home and explain your new heating system, air conditioning, and indoor air quality appliances. The secret to J.C. Heating's success in the Monterey Bay Area for 30 years? We offer safety, comfort, and value. Pretty basic. If you're building or remodeling, or just want to get rid of your old inefficient furnace, call us at 831-475-6538. Want to know the latest in high efficiency heating and cooling? Call me. Trouble with your ducting? Those critters will get in if you don't watch out. Call JC Heating. We want to hear from you. And for those of you who suffer from asthma or allergies, ask about our perfect air purifier. JC Heating and Air Conditioning. Regular people. I'm Chris, a regular guy who wants to get in your house and fix it. Call us at 831-475-6538. JC Heating, 475-6538.
Helicopters for a day or helicopters for a lifetime? We got it right here at Specialized Helicopters.
Ever dream of flying a helicopter? Maybe you'd just like to go for a ride. Today's the day at Specialized Helicopters in Watsonville. Owner, Chief Pilot, Chris Gallardi.
Every day is a good day to go fly. So why not take advantage of that? Have some fun.
Watch the TV segment from the Travels with Romney TV show at travelswithromney.com or visit specializedheli.com. Specialized Helicopters at the Watsonville Airport and 24/7 at travelswithromney.com.
Hi, this is Nancy Norris with Norris Financial Senior Benefits and Services. I want to thank you listeners for catching our new Boomer Talk program on Mondays from 1 to 2. We're answering questions for those of you who are dealing with elder care issues, financial issues, retirement, planning for your estate, anything along those lines. Give us a call Mondays from 1 to 2 on KSCO AM 1080. Or you can give us a call directly at Norris Financial, 408-294-5390.
Hello, I'm Pete Middlecoff with the Santa Cruz Host Lions Club. Get in on the fun, the good, and the youth by attending the 2006 Lions Bowl this Saturday at 1 p.m. at Cabrillo College. Have fun watching the graduating seniors all-stars from Santa Cruz County take on the all-stars from San Mateo County in some great football. Do good because the Lions use all the proceeds from this game to help people in this community see and hear. Honor our youth by giving them a rousing send-off to their college years. Join Bill Graff and Doug Winfrey as they broadcast the game live on AM 1340 KOMY. Go for the fun, the good, and the youth. It's the 2006 Lions Bowl, Saturday 1 p.m. at Cabrillo College.
Brought to you in part by Lloyd's Tire Service. When you think quality, think Lloyd's on River Street in Santa Cruz and at the corner of Airport and Freedom in Freedom. And by Outdoor World. Before you head for the great outdoors, head for Outdoor World in Santa Cruz, Capitola, or Monterey.
Welcome back to the second half of the Saturday special. I'm Mr. Logic, sitting in for Michael. And, boy, we're running out of time quickly here. I guess I prepared too much stuff here. I'm not going to be able to get into it all, I'm afraid. Just want to quickly mention, since before we get back to what we're talking about, Pluto has now two new moons called Nix and Hydra. This was just according to the Fox News announcement 2 days ago on June 22nd. And it says Nix, N-I-X, was originally spelled N-Y-X, because N-Y-X is the Greek goddess of darkness, and Hydra, the other moon, is a nine-headed serpent that guarded the underworld. And, of course, Pluto was the Roman god of the underworld. But there's already a near-Earth object named NYX, So the International Astronomical Union decided to change the spelling to NIX to avoid confusion. This summer, the IAU will debate whether Pluto should remain a planet. The discovery of icy objects slightly larger than Pluto last year reinvigorated the argument over whether to demote Pluto or to add the other add other new planets to our solar system. I was going to talk a whole lot on that topic just itself, but we're not going to have time to get into that. Instead, I was talking about UFOs, and a comment that I believe it was Arthur C. Clarke made. He said something to the effect, either there is other life in the universe or there isn't. And either of those consequences is extremely profound. So the question of whether or not there are UFOs coming from other planets and other solar systems and whatever really hinges on the question, what is the chances of life being somewhere else in the universe? And that hinges on the idea, well, how easy is it to create life? Is life a one-time shot, a one-time miracle that just happened to occur on our planet? Or is it something that's prevalent all over the universe? Well, to help answer this question, I'm going to make a slight diversion here for a bit. And this is taking me into another topic, which I would have liked to have had some more time to talk about. By now, you're all familiar with the famous Da Vinci Code, which is now a movie and a book and everything. About the time, or actually probably even before the Da Vinci Code was written, there was another book that came out by another author by the name of Michael Drosnin. And he came out with a similar sounding title called, his book was called The Bible Code. The Bible Code. Now we have the Da Vinci Code. Anyway, according to his book, the Bible Code is first of all, in contrast to the Da Vinci Code, which is a work of fiction, at least so it's claimed, the Bible Code claims to be a book dealing with factuality. According to the proponents of the Bible Code, the Bible can be decoded through an equidistant letter sequencing program. An equidistance letter sequencing program. The idea here is you take every nth letter starting someplace, and you can have n be whatever number you like, 7, 19, whatever. You then print out that string of letters as one big long sequence, and then search from left to right, right to left, top to bottom, so on, any direction that you might find amusing, and try to see if you can find some interesting patterns. Just like the prophecies of soothsayers past and present, all the predictions made by this Bible Code thing are actually post-predictions, not one psychic astrologer warned us about the 9/11 incident, for example. Let me just briefly back up here a minute and explain what's going on here. There was this idea that the Bible was divinely inspired, and the idea here was that if you do this Bible Code thing where you start off somewhere in the Bible, pick a letter, and then you skip N letters and keep doing that like I just described here, you will eventually find words hidden in the Bible. And these are supposedly words that were written there by some divine writer. After all, how could a human being write a book and have all these hidden messages just perfectly lined up in the letters that make up the text of that document? So this was an indication that the Bible was somehow divinely inspired. Now, what were these things they found in the Bible when they did that? They found predictions of the future. The Bible was written, several thousand years ago. They found predictions of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. They found the assassination of Abraham Lincoln predicted in the Bible. They found all kinds of things that hadn't happened yet. Were in the even the 9/11 incident was predicted in the Bible if you look through it by picking equidistant spacings of letters. Anyway, continuing here with this science and technology at scientificamerican.com, which I'm reading from here. Just like the prophecies of soothsayers past and present, all of these predictions are actually post-dictions. To be tested scientifically, Bible codes would need to predict events before they happen. But they don't, because they can't. As Danish physicist Niels Bohr averted, predictions are difficult. especially about the future. Instead, in 1997, Drosnin proposed this test of his thesis. Quote, when my critics find a message about the assassination of a prime minister encrypted in Moby Dick, then I'll believe them. That's a close quote there. Well, it turns out that his critics did accept his challenge, and they did look through Moby Dick, and they applied the very same technique that Drosnin had done in the Bible, and they did find predictions of Martin Luther King's death, Sirhan Sirhan, John Kennedy. It goes on. They got a whole, they publish all the results here. There's a website I can give you to anybody who's interested, and they list all the things that were predicted by Moby Dick using the same technique that they used in the Bible. One of the main skeptics is a scientist in New Mexico called Dave Thomas, and he has an amusing anecdote that he associates with this whole business. He says, as my wife and I were driving through New Mexico on Sunday, June 14th, 1998, we listened to the Game 6 of the Chicago Bulls-Utah Jazz National Basketball Association playoffs. As the game drew to a close, we heard the Utah crowd groan as Michael Jordan sank the winning basket. And then and there, a chill went down my spine. Oh, my God, I thought to myself, the Tolstoy code is real. More than 7 weeks before, he says he had undertaken a search for NBA teams and players using the technique of equidistant letter spacing popularized in the book The Bible Code by Michael Drosnin. Unlike Drosnin, however, he wasn't searching in the Hebrew Torah. Instead, he was looking in Book 1 of an English translation of Leo Tolstoy's epic, War and Peace. He had wondered if the NBA playoff winner could actually be predicted in advance. What did his April research reveal? The word Chicago was found encoded only once in War and Peace. The word jazz was not encoded at all. But there was more. Wait, there's more, he says. Bulls, the word bulls, was also encoded 32 times in the book. Chicago, bulls was in there 32 times and found 14 hidden occurrences of the word Jordan, the guy who scored the winning basket. When he made his prediction, there were only 16 teams in the playoff, and the Bulls, while they were favored, almost lost it on more than one occasion. And on June 14, his prediction came to pass. Not only had Tolstoy predicted the victor would be the Chicago Bulls, but that Jordan's key role in the victory had been forecast almost 2 months in advance. And so he says, now we are left to ponder the sombering truth. Either the Bible code nonsense is just a general arcane mathematical technique which can be employed to find any desired message or prediction hidden in any book, or else Leo Tolstoy must be the supreme being who created the universe. Anyway, this has been a bit of diversion on the Bible code, and the reason I brought it up is in conjunction with life in the universe. Now, the idea behind the Bible code is if you take random letters and just take enough of them and put them together in any shape you want, it's virtually impossible to not find meaningful words that can be discovered. If you have enough randomness occurring, structure will come out of the randomness, and it comes out in a very predictable way, actually. Now, the reason I bring this up is because the claims by Drosnin and believers of the Bible code is that divine inspiration had to be taking place in order for the Bible code to be real. If messages were hidden in the Bible, somebody had to put them there. They couldn't have just happened by themselves. Now, wait a minute. Think about this a minute. Haven't you heard similar arguments before in terms of life in the universe? If there's life in the universe, it had to have been created by some intelligent being. It couldn't have just happened automatically, could it? Well, if you apply the same philosophy and the same wording that's used in the Bible code, substitute, instead of letters of the alphabet, substitute organic compounds and go through the same discussion. What is the chance that organic compounds could suddenly form in a meaningful way in the universe without divine intervention? Now, the Bible code takes place in like one or two dimensions. It's something that occurs on a printed page. Imagine a three-dimensional sea of primordial soup containing the right chemicals. Isn't it even more possible, then, that the right combination could occur spontaneously as well? Think about that. How did life form in the universe? It isn't as implausible or impossible as it may be claimed by some of those who do make those claims. 479-1080 is the number if you'd like to join me here for the final moments of the show. I'm Mr. Logic, sitting in for, Michael Swirling. Let's go to our call now, our phones now. We have Jim, who wants to talk about a UFO story, since we're kind of talking about things in the universe. Jim, welcome to the Saturday special.
Hi, Mr. Logic. I'm out in Corralitos today.
Well, hi.
And I just thought I'd share, during the middle 50s, I was a Marine Corps pilot, and that was a time when UFOs were much more in vogue than they are today, I guess.
Yeah, what happened to them? How come they went away?
Well, that's for you to figure out. But anyway, the story that I had was one time another pilot and I, in each in our own plane, were practicing instrument flying, and we were flying south down the coast of California. And he was the way you practice do that is you put a bag over your head, basically the person who's flying instruments, and then there's a chase pilot who keeps that person out of trouble and keeps them from running into somebody else. So I was the chase plane, and I was off to his right, flying south. I looked over to our left, off our 9 o'clock, and I saw six silvery discs flying at about our altitude in formation. And that really floored me, and I talked to the guy over the radio, and I said, "Tal, get out from under the bag. I see something here at 9 o'clock." He pulled the bag out, took a look, and by that time, three of them had disappeared, and there were only three there. And then in a few more seconds, those three disappeared. And it really floored us, and we talked about it. We got back to the ground, and we talked more about it, and we decided that we were looking off toward Bakersfield, where there are a lot of oil tanks, storage tanks on the ground, and that there was some kind of an inversion that caused it to look like
a mirage.
It was a mirage, and it looked for all the world like they were at our altitude. We were about 30,000 feet, but it was very interesting, and we figured it out, and that they weren't UFOs, but. It was a good story to tell around the hangar.
Yeah, there are probably a lot of such stories, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The problem is the ones that get resolved, like the ones you're talking about now, never get to the popular press. And so it sounds like the only things that ever show up are the ones that somehow can't be explained as easily. Not that they don't have explanations, but the ones that do get explained get rushed under the carpet.
Yeah, they don't sell papers with those, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting story. Glad to hear that one.
Thought I'd pass that along.
All right, thanks for calling.
Sure thing.
Let's go to Billy Sunshine. We're running. We only got about 3 or 4 minutes to go. So let's bring Bill. Whoops. Billy, I hit the wrong button. I'm a newbie here. I'm a newbie. I don't know what I'm doing. I pushed the wrong button. I'm going to go right directly to on air and see if this is Billy, if I can. Hello? Okay, try it now. Hello, is this Billy? I'm not getting anybody.
Hello?
Oh, you are there. Is this Billy?
Yes, my name is Bob Steinhaus.
Oh, you're okay, it's a different person.
Yes, sorry.
Okay, I accidentally hung up on somebody here, so okay.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Bible code, or the Hebrew code it is referred to as.
Mm-hmm.
it's my understanding that... there's certainly a far more complexity to this code than you have alluded to.
Well, let me back up a minute and explain. I originally, when I first heard about this idea, I was very fascinated because it made predictions about supposedly things that hadn't happened yet.
It doesn't predict.
Well, that was the claims that it did predict.
Yeah, I know. That's because you were referring to a reporter named Michael Drazen, who is a reporter from the Washington Post. But this was developed by physicists, mathematicians.
A couple of Israelis.
One of the world's most prominent mathematicians, Elihu Rips.
Right.
And theoretical physicist Doran Weitzman, Gerald Schroeder, and Daniel Michelson. And, of course, Harold Gans from the National Security Agency, who later became a working partner with these mathematicians and physicists. This entire investigation is still going on, and it is supported by the Israeli government.
Yeah, I mean,
predictions are not possible, but there are probabilities, and the whole thing is based on quantum mechanics, and it is a far complex. You cannot find statistical relevant codes in War and Peace or Moby Dick. These codes are statistically relevant, and they do represent a means by which to examine the history of the past in some detail.
So the claims of Kennedy's assassination and everything is humbug,
no.
Then, right?
I don't know about the Kennedy assassination, but there are an amazing array of unexplainable factual information that's available through studying this code system. They describe the mathematicians, the physicists who are involved in it today as comparable to the Manhattan Project.
And
the Israeli government is funding it. I can tell you one thing that's very fascinating that I think hooked and lured the Israeli government. Of course, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, which was disclosed
in
year
the book,
in
yeah.
advance.
By the way, we're running out of time. I'm going to have to cut you off here because we're coming up on news
sure.
at the top of the hour. If I come back and do another show, we can continue this some more, and I hope we can.
I would love to talk about it because it's certainly an incredible discovery, and it's still being explored.
Got to run. Sorry. Bye-bye.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can
All
hear
right.
you.
Why don't we run through the news and get to Billy Sunshine's call just because I'm really anxious to hear what his ostrich in the end of the world thing is about.
Oh, okay.
Could you do that for me?
Is anybody coming on?
He's
on
number
hour?
One.
Just run over the news.
Just go through the news. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Cool.
Let's bring up Billy. Billy, sorry I hung up on you by mistake.
No problem. So the year is 2018.
2018.
Yeah. So it's about four, five, 6 years ago. I'm reading a newspaper, and there's a little article, very little article, about how some scientists in Australia or someplace, astronomers, predicted there's going to be a very close asteroid meeting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I reported that several years ago, in fact.
Well, then a couple of days later, I read a correction where they said, you know, we did the numbers, and it's not going to be as close as we thought.
Yeah, I remember reading that, too.
I'm not one of these conspiracy guys, but I believe that, in fact, they were told to, you know, imagine if people actually believe the world was going to end in 2018, my friend.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it would be kind of chaotic.
Yeah. Now, here's the ostrich thing quickly, and I will talk more about that other thing the next time you're on, because that's interesting. You know, it's like certain facts. People get so bedazzled by a fact that they miss the truth. The moon landing never happened because, after all, the Van Allen Belt radiation prevented it, right?
Well, that's one of the claims, yeah.
Yeah. These people, global warming, because, I don't know, it's CO2 or it's water, whatever, they find a fact. Or the fellas now with the World Trade Center, when a vacuum comes down in 10 seconds, and therefore it's a fact, but it seems to get in the way of the truth, much like an ostrich. And here's the final thing I'll leave you with, and that is the title of the book that's about the end of the world is called But By Then, It Was Too Late. What do you want to say about that?
Sounds like a good title for a book.
Well, isn't it always thus?
Yeah.
Now, if we wait for the last skeptic to get on board, it will be too late if it's anything serious.
Right. Well, we got to run here. I'm being kicked out of the talk studios.
Great to hear you again, my friend.
Yeah, I hope I get back here and we can talk some more.
You bet.
All right, thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I guess this is the end of the Saturday special. I've been Mr. Logic sitting in for Michael Zwirling. And until next time, remember to always keep an open mind and question everything, especially the self-evident.
That's all, folks. KSL Santa Cruz, Camel, Watsonville.
Delete online predators. Call 1-800-THE-LOST or visit cybertipline.com to learn how to protect your kids' online life. A message from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Ad Council.
Wildfires in the Sedona, Arizona area slowly being contained. Fox's Adam Housley's there. So far, they've blackened more than 4,200 acres. They haven't yet given us an official tally of the percentage of containment yet. As of last night, it was 15%.
Some residents who'd been evacuated from near Oak Creek Canyon now being allowed back to those homes, and officials are hoping for full containment of the blaze by next Wednesday. In Mexico for a resort vacation, a Pennsylvania teen has died in a fall down an elevator shaft at his hotel. Relatives say 16-year-old Andrew Smith was vacationing with family, his mother telling the Reading Eagle the boy died of severe injuries after falling Wednesday at the Royal Solaris Hotel in Cancun. A hotel official, declining to comment, and details of that incident are still unclear. Israel disrupting a meeting of Palestinians, President Mahmoud Abbas having to cancel a meeting with Hamas leaders when Israeli troops entered Gaza to arrest two Hamas militants. The first such raid in the coastal strip by Israel since the Israeli army withdrew last year. 83-year-old Aaron Spelling has died after a stroke he suffered last weekend. Spelling credited with producing over 3,000 TV programs as well as 14 major motion pictures. And most everything he did was a popular success. Though Fox's Lisa Bernhard tells us he never won critical acclaim.
Despite racking up millions of hours of TV, he personally was only nominated for 7 Emmys, winning 2 of them.
The Reverend Melvin H. Watson, who helped train Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders, has died. He was 98. And Andre bidding adieu, an emotional Andre Agassi, announcing today he's leaving tennis. He told reporters at Wimbledon that after Wimbledon, he'll retire after playing the U.S. Open. Agassi's been dealing with injuries now for years. The U.S. Open begins in August, and again, that'll be Andre's last tournament professionally. I'm Chris Barnes, Fox News Radio.
As you're listening to KSCO AM 1080, it's 5 minutes past noon, and I'm Jay Cruz with a quick look at your Central Coast weather forecast for today. Mostly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning with southwest wind at 5 miles per hour with highs around 67. Tonight, mostly cloudy, fog with northwest wind around 3 miles per hour with lows around 53. Sunday, mostly cloudy, patches of fog in the morning with southwest wind at 7 miles per hour and highs around 66. Sunday night, mostly cloudy, fog with south wind at 5 miles per hour, lows around 54. Monday, partly cloudy, patches of fog in the morning, highs around 65. Monday night, partly cloudy, fog with lows around 53, and Tuesday partly cloudy with areas of fog in the morning and highs around 65. In Monterey Bay Boaters forecast for today, calls for light winds becoming southwest 5 to 10 knots in the afternoon with wind waves at 1 foot, a northwest swell of 2 to 5 feet every 9 seconds with areas of dense fog in the morning and then patchy fog in the afternoon. Stay tuned to KSCO AM 1080 for perspectives. Stick around.